Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. We promised we'd be back in time for summer, and here we are with a special show dedicated to the moon, or at least the engineers, scientists, politicians and astronauts who took us there. 40 years on from the iconic Apollo 11 moon landing, we're going to take you on a tour of the technical achievements, the cultural impacts and the future of lunar exploration with our guest, Apollo 11's biggest fan, Chris Riley. And an old chum makes a return. Producer Andy's been on location at NASA in Washington to look at how our American friends will be marking the anniversary.
It's been 40 years, it's time to go back, but we're going back to stay, and it's not just the moon, it's moon as a stepping stone to much broader and ambitious goals.
And I'm Stephen Moss, and I'm lucky enough to be meeting legendary astronaut Buzz Aldrin to talk about that amazing experience with Apollo 11 40 years ago.
Hold on to your seats for blastoff. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Hello and welcome back. Did you all have a good summer holiday? Well, not quite summer. Our panel today are The Guardian's David Adam and the author, broadcaster and all-round Apollo expert Chris Riley. Now, guys, bearing in mind that today is July the 6th and we just had a heat wave in London. How was your heat wave, both of you? David?
Oh, it was really hot.
Did you enjoy it?
I did, yeah, I did.
And then, Chris, what did you spend your time doing last week?
Well, I must admit, when it gets hot like this, it gives you a little flavour of life at the Cape, doesn't it, in Florida, back in 69. So that's where I was.
Does everything relate back to that? Is that
my whole life.
Yeah. Well, anyway, in exactly 2 weeks, NASA will celebrate the 40th anniversary of one of its most remarkable achievements. On July 20th, 1969, Neil Armstrong, Eugene Buzz Aldrin and Michael Collins reached the moon in Apollo 11. Armstrong and Aldrin landed, and after a couple of hours in the lunar module, Armstrong became the first human to step on the surface of another celestial object. To celebrate, The Guardian ran a commemorative issue of G2 last week, looking into all aspects of this remarkable achievement. In this podcast, we're going to take you through some of the highlights. Chris, let's start right at the beginning, or at least at the beginning as far as most of the members of the public are concerned. In 1962, John F. Kennedy makes his famous speech that we are going to land a person on the moon by the end of the decade. What happens next?
Well, actually, just to understand what happens next, you've got to step back a little bit, because the thing is, when Kennedy came to power in January 61, new president in the White House, not dissimilar to this year, in fact, no one really knew what he was going to do with NASA in the same case now. And he had a couple of choices, really. You know, they'd already just started their kind of manned spaceflight program, and he could carry on with that, or he could go and build a space station or something like that, or even cancel the whole thing. And during that first few weeks in office, a lot of things went wrong for Kennedy. The Bay of Pigs happened in Cuba. And then suddenly in April, just a few weeks afterwards, of course, Yuri Gagarin was shoved up into space and orbited the Earth, first spaceman to do that. And suddenly Kennedy had to make an important announcement that was going to reestablish America's sort of position on the world stage, if you like. And he turned to his vice president, LBJ, Lyndon B. Johnson, and said, you know, what should we do? And not Johnson was closer to NASA than Kennedy was. And a few years before, a planetary scientist called Harold Urey had said to NASA when they'd started their program, he'd said, look, I think we should go and do something in terms of exploration on the moon, because the moon's got a lot of rocks preserved that have gone on Earth. So the early history of the solar system's probably pretty much intact there and, you know, and up for grabs scientifically. So NASA had sort of tentatively started this lunar exploration program back in the 50s, and they had this as an option on the table that we could then sort of up it a bit and send people there maybe by 1970. So they said that to Johnson. Johnson recommended to Kennedy that we should go full steam ahead on this moon program.
I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before this decade is out of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth. No single space project in this period will be more impressive to mankind or more important for the long-range exploration of space, and none will be so difficult or expensive to accomplish. We propose to accelerate
at
the development...
At that stage, did Kennedy or Johnson even, or any of the political class, did they think, right, well, this is a shoo-in, or did they have the information to make that judgment about the 1970 deadline, or was it fairly arbitrary?
It was a pretty big long shot. I mean, I think NASA's original estimate was that something like $11 billion it would take to do by 1970. And I think in the end, it was something like three times that cost. So it wasn't a shoo-in at all. And in fact, as soon as Kennedy had made that speech, the one to Congress, and then a few months later, the one at Rice University, that we choose to go to the moon speech, he suddenly started to kind of get cold feet about it a little bit, because, of course, this was a huge job. When the first speech was made, of course, America hadn't even put a man into space. You know, Al Shepard was yet to make his suborbital flight. And here they were saying they were going to go to the moon, put a man on the moon, return him to Earth by the end of the decade. A huge, huge jump. And he started to doubt whether they could actually do it. And he started looking around for an alternative kind of big plan, big program. And Johnson simply said, look, to be second in space is to be second in everything. We've got to do this. And that was really the sort of thing that pushed it forward.
So let's go into the technical achievement then, the technical challenge that the engineers faced in 1962. David, your piece last week looked at this. What was the sort of overarching problem that they faced?
One of the things that emerged during the research for the G2 piece that I wasn't aware of was that apparently, because the Americans had done such a good job during the Manhattan Project of building a sleek, small atomic bomb, that the rockets that they had developed, their ICBMs, were actually quite small. And you compare them to the Russians, who had a giant, bulky atomic bomb, which essentially they'd come second in the race to build a bomb. But that meant their rockets were far better suited to taking heavy payloads into space, which is what you need for manned spaceflight. So essentially, although the Americans were technologically ahead, they, in some ways, they were behind. And if you go back to the early 60s, their rockets, they couldn't get a rocket off. The rockets were exploding on the launch pad. They were shaking themselves to bits. If you look at some of the footage of the explosions, the last thing you would want to do would be to put people on top of one of those and send them up into space. So it's worth remembering they were starting from a relatively low base. And then, of course, they had to solve... They hadn't decided, we should say at the beginning, how to do this. Looking back, it looks obvious. But there was a serious plan through most of the early 60s to build a giant rocket. And they were going to send this one rocket all the way to the moon, where it would sort of reverse and land, and they would all get out, and then they'd all get back in again, and then they'd all take off again in this giant rocket and come all the way back to Earth again. So it's a little bit like you would imagine a school child deciding how to go to the moon, and then...
I'll just add to that, it's spot on, you know, David, because it was the most obvious way to go. You build a big rocket, put people on the top, and away you go. But of course, although that was the most popular choice at headquarters in Washington for NASA, no one had really thought about how you'd climb out of this giant, you know, skyscraper you'd landed on the moon and get down to the surface. You take an elevator, climb down a rope ladder, you know. Some of the early footage actually shows them trying to kind of winch themselves down. There were no ladders, you know, and it was very hard to do in a pressure suit. So they needed a couple of alternative methods for going up there. Von Braun's favourite was to launch a series of Saturn V's into Earth orbit and then assemble a moonship there in space, send that there, a little slightly smaller one than the big one you talked about, and then come back in the same way. But sending, you know, a ton of Saturn V's up into orbit and assembling something there when they'd still not launched a single man into space was also terrifying, a terrifying prospect. So the final opportunity to do it was this much simpler method in some respects called Lunar Orbit Rendezvous, LOR. And this was a technique that had been dreamt up in Russia about sort of 70 years before by a chap called Kondrachuk. And it involved a couple of tiny spacecraft going there, and then one of them going down to the surface with two guys on, and then coming back and joining back to the mothership, and then throwing all the bits away as you didn't need them, and coming back in a very small bit, which is essentially what they did at the end. But that was the third and least popular option at one point in the early 60s.
Well, I suppose if you write it down, it sounds much more complicated. The idea of rendezvousing spaceships up in space when these things are moving very fast, no one's done that. Never mind putting a man into space, you're not actually able to manoeuvre them particularly well necessarily, and so, you know, the complexity increases, which brings me on to my next point about the engineering challenge of this, because we hear about the astronauts, Armstrong, Al Shepard, as we've talked about, we hear about Buzz Aldrin, all these people who trained hugely to get up there and took huge risks, but there were thousands and thousands of engineers in the pyramid sort of below them to getting them there.
Something like 400,000 people across America worked on Apollo between, you know, when it was announced in 61 and through to the end of the program in 72. It's a colossal number. When you think about it, you think, well, how could you even employ that many people? But these were all subcontractors and subcontractors that worked across the whole nation to do all this stuff. 40,000 people alone worked on the command module, which was essentially designed and built in California at a company called North American Aviation. But then all the different systems on it, ranging from navigation to life support, were all done, you know, right across the country and outsourced, I suppose, if you like. And that's why the numbers ballooned up in the way they did. And then if you look right down to the tiniest details, how did they get the command module actually to the Cape? How did they get each bit of the Saturn V rocket built by three different contractors around the country? How did they bring them all there? And suddenly you've got this huge infrastructure where there's a plane called the Super Guppy that's got this massive bubble body that you can shove one of the stages of the Saturn V into and fly it there. And then the first stage had to come by barge through the Panama Canal. There was all that infrastructure that needed building. Suddenly, 400,000 people doesn't sound too many.
It's 400,000 people and not very much time. Was there a lot of stress involved? I mean, I feel silly asking that question, but you all, again, imagine that the astronauts have to go through huge amounts of physical and psychological sort of stress to get up there and train and be prepared. But what about the engineers? Is it fair to say that they also had their share of problems like that?
Oh, for sure. I mean, it's commonly thought no one died in the Cold War, in a way. I mean, there were a handful of kind of casualties and plane crashes and things. But actually, a great deal of stress and premature death was caused by this end-of-the-decade deadline. So middle management in this huge sort of pyramid of 400,000 people was an extremely stressful place to be, because these deadlines were bordering on impossible in terms of time, as you raise there. And so, you know, even if you did do 7 days a week, which was routine, and 100 hours a week, you still were struggling to kind of meet those deadlines. And NASA was on their back the whole time saying, you know, if one thing's not finished, then the next thing can't be done. And if you look at the program of sort of test flights that were unmanned in the run-up to Apollo 7, the first manned flight in 68, a lot of reshuffling had to be done because spacecraft weren't ready. So the lunar module that was being built by Grumman Aviation in Long Island, just near New York, they had so many problems with it. They just kept ending up delivering this thing just on time, and then there were 400 problems with it that needed fixing, and it couldn't fly, and the whole mission needed rejigging so it would go up on the next one. This happened all the way through with everything from the spacecraft to the space suits.
Well, of course, Apollo 1 burned up on the launch pad during a test because of problems with the command module. There was a spark in some faulty wiring, and in the pure oxygen atmosphere, the three astronauts in there died, and that also caused a lot of soul searching and another sort of huge numbers of setbacks but in some ways, I suppose that was, I don't want to say there's anything good about it, but what it meant was that these problems didn't happen on the way to the moon, which probably would have killed the whole project. Were there other points during the early stages of the program, Chris, where it looked like this was just not going to be possible?
Well, you know, if you look at Project Gemini, which was this bridge between Mercury, the single manned space capsules, and Apollo, you know, a great deal of lessons needed to be learned during Gemini, both from kind of rendezvous and how long you could sort of stay in space, and even whether you could go outside the spacecraft and do a spacewalk. And those missions often, you know, didn't go to plan. Gemini 8 had problems with one of the thrusters on the Atlas that they were docking with. They made the first docking, Neil Armstrong and Dave Scott. And then they went into this spin, which was very hard to kind of get out of and nearly killed both of them. And actually, Armstrong, it was his only mission before Apollo 11. He only spent 10 hours in space before, you know, he goes and lands on the moon for the first time. So, you know, things did go wrong the whole time.
20 seconds and counting. T-minus 15 seconds, guidance is internal, 12, 11, 10, 9, ignition sequence start, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, all engine running, liftoff, we have a liftoff, 32 minutes past the hour, liftoff on Apollo 11.
Clear. We got a roll program.
Neil Armstrong reporting the roll and pitch program, which puts Apollo 11 on a proper heading.
It took off. It took 4 days to get to the moon. Once they got there, Chris, what happened after the Eagle landed on Tranquility Base?
Well, of course, for Armstrong, you know, that was the sort of 13 out of 10 in terms of his challenge for the mission, the actual landing.
Well, before we go on, was he excited at all? Because none of the transcripts I've read have him being excited or emotional about anything.
Well, the thing is, it's sort of misleading if you like to go through the transcripts and look for excitement, because the thing about all of these men and all 24 men who flew to the moon and the 12 who landed there were picked through a very rigorous selection process, essentially, that threw up a particular kind of person. I mean, many of them, if you look back at their kind of biographies, as I've written about in G2, were from a similar background. They were all very kind of active in the Boy Scout movement, and many of them, of course, had an utter love of flight from very, very early on. I mean, from the ages of 2 or 3, you know, they were obsessed by aircraft and aviation. Many of them had parents who perhaps were involved in it and so looked up, you know, with awe at these people. But those that didn't come from a kind of flight background just found those pieces of inspiration in movies and movie tone news and stuff. And so they all had this similar background, but it's wrong to see them as sort of unemotional characters. The thing about them all with this test pilot background that they had was that they were trained to be very analytical about things. So as Mike Collins told us in The Shadow of the Moon, you know, if you're asked, what's your fuel status and you're flying in formation, you don't go, well, I kind of feel that my fuel's rather low at the moment and it does make me a bit anxious, but I guess it'll be all right. You don't say that. You just say 4.2, red 6, 4.2, or whatever your call sign is, you know, because that's the clipped sort of speech that you need to do. And it was no different going to the moon. In fact, it was worse in a way, because the quality of communication was a lot harder across a longer distance and you had to be brief.
Forward. Forward. 40 feet down, 2.5, picking up some dust. 30 feet, 2.5 down, straight shadow. 4 forward, drift into the right level. 9.5,
30 seconds.
Forward, drift. Ready? Contact light. Okay, engine stop. Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
Apollo 11 obviously was the first to land on the moon itself. And obviously at this stage had taken things the furthest. Was there any concern that when Eagle landed that it would never be able to get off the surface again? I mean, they'd never tested that before.
Yes, well, the ascent engine for their return to orbit ran on a couple of fuel types that were so corrosive that they absolutely couldn't put them through the engine before to test it, because they would have just eaten away at the metal. So this engine had been tested in development, of course, but this particular engine that was on the moon had never been ignited and flown, and so it was its first test firing. I mean, they were pretty sure it had worked. There were very few moving parts on it, and so essentially it ignited itself by mixing these fuels together, which just exploded in the vacuum.
So they tested this for the first time on the moon when they wanted to leave.
Correct.
There's a fabulous bit in the Shadow of the Moon where you show a clip of Richard Nixon doing a pre-recorded speech to the American people in the event that the engine didn't fire, and that he said these guys are stranded up there. There's no hope.
There was a really beautiful speech written, you're quite right, for Nixon to go on TV and record should it happen. In Shadow, we used the beginning of another speech to sort of hint at this possible speech he'd have to make if they didn't get back. And then Mike Collins reads the actual speech. I think it's beautifully written, and it says that at the end, there's something about the moon will be forever mankind, because whenever we look up at it in the future, if they had got stuck there, we would know there were two human beings there, albeit kind of mummified on the surface. And it could have been kind of, in a way, a very kind of romantic thing in itself.
Okay, well, fortunately, they did make it back, and we'll talk a bit about the legacy when they got back to Earth in just a moment. All of this stuff is explored in much more detail in Chris Riley's new book, Apollo 11, The Owner's Workshop Manual, which you can probably use to build your own Apollo command module if you fancied. Also, The Guardian's full Apollo 11 coverage, which includes how Pink Floyd's David Gilmour reacted to the landing, is at guardian.co.uk/science. Over in the US, they've been leading the world in space exploration ever since the 1960s. As America prepares to celebrate the Apollo anniversary, Science Weekly's Man in the US, Andy Duckworth, has been speaking to some of the people in the know in Washington about their memories of the ambitious space program.
I'm here at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm on the second floor overlooking some of the space exhibits. There's a few rockets. There's a replica of the Hubble Space Telescope. There's a Russian capsule down there. At the other end of the museum's all the more boring kind of civilian planes and aircraft. So this is where all the interesting stuff is, I suppose. And down below me to my right here is a backup lunar lander. It could have actually gone to the moon if anything failed with the one that actually did land on the moon. At the moment it's being repaired and restored. I've been speaking to one of the men who's been using scissors and sticky tape to put it all back together again. So 40 years on, an incredible achievement, landing a man on the moon. And to put it into some context, I've been speaking to Alan Needell, who's senior curator here at the National Air and Space Museum. So, what's next? I guess that's up to the government, who hold the purse strings, and NASA.
My name is Dr. John Olson, and I'm the Exploration Systems Mission Directorate Integration Office. We're going back to the moon, not for flags and footsteps, but we're going back to the moon for a long-term, sustained presence, and we're going to use the moon as a stepping stone to Mars. We're going to look at other interesting spots like asteroids or near-Earth objects. With today's technologies, it's currently about a six-month trip to Mars, up to a year stay in order to do useful work, and then about a six-month journey back. So you're looking at a two-year mission, so you're already looking at a fairly significant portion of time for having human beings be off-planet. We notionally have looked at some timelines whereby if we have a human lunar return in 2020, we look at having an outpost in place around the 2024-ish time frame, 2024. Perhaps maybe in the 2030, 2035 time frame, we could start looking for a human mission to Mars. And there are many who would say, you know, that's just not soon enough. We ought to go there sooner.
So what does America make of it after all these years? I'm now inside the Apollo to the Moon exhibition here at the museum, and some incredible exhibits in here. There's a replica of the Saturn V rocket, some of the actual rocket engines. There we've got President Kennedy giving a speech about space.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
I'm Stephen Moss, and for this Science Weekly Apollo special, I'm now joined by one of the people who made that heroic flight with Apollo 11, Buzz Aldrin. Do you recognize that person who walked on the moon 40 years ago?
Oh, yes, yes. It was an awesome responsibility.
I read different things about whether it bothered you that you were the second person.
Yeah.
Some people say it bothers you, some people say it doesn't bother you.
Well, we're dealing with very competitive people who always want to get the most out of the opportunities that come along, even though I did not relish the idea of many speeches and celebrations and being on a pedestal as a hero. I didn't enter the space program to want to do that. And certainly, being first outside the spacecraft would bring much, much more responsibility. I really wasn't looking for that sort of thing.
So it didn't bother you particularly?
I wouldn't say that. It's continually being asked, didn't it bother you that you were second? And then always being introduced as the second man on the moon? That is a degrading title right off the bat, instead of being a member of the first landing mission to reach the moon.
And then afterwards, the whole breakdown, you attribute to losing the discipline of being in the...
Losing the structure, losing the...
And the goal, once you'd achieved the goal, you didn't know what you were aiming for, presumably.
Right. I had in mind a career in the Air Force, but very nebulous ways that might take. I had been in squadron level at the flight commander position, not at squadron ops. I'd experienced those things, but now I'm virtually at the fringes of general officer rank, and I've missed 11 years. What is it going to be as I try and renew my Air Force career? And it was disappointing that did not work. It just appeared that was not a pathway that I wanted to continue to pursue.
And then the 70s were almost a lost decade for you, weren't they? I mean, they were lost in...
Yes, it really was.
To the booms and the depression and the almost a complete breakdown in a way.
But I got remarried and that didn't work out at all. Yeah. But then I attained a successful sobriety and I've been able to... continue that with distinct attention, and it wasn't long before describing that in a way was not the journey to the moon, it was return to Earth. Clearly, that was the challenging part. How do I achieve something like that and then come back and readjust?
The essence of the problem
was... And I was not all that successful in my control, my decisions of readjustment that led to further discouragement and lack of structure, lack of guidance, and...
I don't know whether this is your phrase.
Just
this is,
things what, came apart.
What does a man do for an encore after walking on the moon?
No, it's a descriptive what comes next.
Yeah, but that was the problem.
Yeah,
you'd walked on the moon at 39. How do you follow that?
You're describing just an average person, and you'd say in that sort of thing, geez, he just wasn't up to it. He had weaknesses. I inherited tendencies in different directions. And those directions, if you inherit them and you feed them in some way with a life of perfection and discipline and achievement, and then remove that all of a sudden, it's probably going to go back to some of the more deep-seated concerns about self-worth and real achievement. Now, you did that as a part of a team. What are you doing now?
Yeah.
So what does that do to a person's ego?
Okay, and last thing, what's it like to have Buzz Lightyear named after you? Is that an honor?
I think it is, yes. And I can't ignore it. So I participate and I make use of the character in introductory remarks that bring a chuckle, especially from young people. So it's useful in that way.
Okay, that's great. Thanks. Okay. Nice to meet you.
Now back to the studio. After Apollo 11, six further missions visited the moon, and other than Apollo 13, all landed there safely. After Apollo 17 came back in December 1972, the project was stopped. And ever since, despite hundreds of astronauts visiting space, no one has ever left Earth orbit. Chris, David, the legacy of Apollo is quite clear, you know, in terms of inspiration to people getting into space. And the obviously, we've talked about the stresses and strains and the people meeting the 1970 deadline. It was quite an amazing thing based on the fact that the technology was very different back then.
Well, actually, even if you look at one of the more recent missions that's just flown to service the Hubble Space Telescope, the techniques that were used for rendezvous and docking with Hubble were essentially pioneered by the Apollo program through Gemini and then, of course, with Apollo itself. So in spaceflight terms, the legacy of Apollo, you know, still trickles on today. We learnt all these sort of difficult techniques of building and constructing things in orbit from Apollo. And whilst many people, you know, they say that in a way with Apollo we did the difficult stuff and then the space stations are sort of come second, it's been the wrong way around in some respects. And that's what sort of stymied any future return to another place in space other than space itself. That's just what we've got to live with, really, basically. That was the way the Cold War sort of threw it up, and we've just got to kind of stick with that. But I think the problem in recent years, as James Cameron put it, was that space is now seen as the destination, if you like, whereas in the 60s, space was seen as this thing we will cross to get somewhere else, whether it was the robotic missions to Mars and the planets in the 70s or humans to the moon. And since then, of course, we just sort of get up into space, and then that's sort of enough. And in a way, it's a bit like kind of sailing to America a few centuries ago and then deciding actually the fun bit was just the sailing, so going around the Isle of Wight more fun than going to America in the years since. And of course that's silly. So in a way, the kind of spirit of Apollo needs rekindling, if you like, in terms of seeing space as something to cross to get to another place to explore.
David, what's happening in terms of the NASA's plans now? You've got Constellation, which is aiming to get back to the moon and potentially even Mars after that some point in the next few decades. What about other countries?
Well, I think it was George Bush, wasn't it, who re-pledged that America would go back to the moon. And I think NASA is still looking at that, although there are issues with the space shuttle because it probably can't have two manned space programs. So while the space shuttle continues to fly, they can't really target the moon again.
And that's offline in a couple of years, next year.
It's supposed to be, yeah. But I think it's all tied up with the space station, isn't it? And I wouldn't be surprised if the shuttle flew longer than they have even said now. But I think, well, we know that China and India are both very interested in the moon, and Europe, of course. So Europe are sending robotic probes. India and China have sent probes to the moon. China might land on the moon quite soon, maybe with some kind of a lunar rover, a bit like the Americans put onto Mars. And so I think it's not quite a space race again. It's certainly not a race for the moon. But I think there's enough countries interested that I think that it becomes a political as well as a scientific and a technical issue.
Could a Chinese person be the next person on the moon, even though the only people that have actually declared that they are going back is the US?
Well, the Chinese have put a man in orbit, and I think it's fair to say that probably China are starting now from a position ahead of where the States were in the early 60s, so you can't rule it out, obviously, because it's already been done. And I think there are issues nowadays about risk and whether we would take the same kind of risks as they took during Apollo. But then I think there's also that if you're looking for any country to have a political point to prove in the way the Americans did in the 60s, then I think you would perhaps say that would be China.
Chris, why was Apollo canned? I mean, there's many books have been written about how disappointing NASA has been in the 70s and 80s and even now. Which I think is unfair, given they've been amazingly good at robotic missions and all the satellites and things. But in terms of human spaceflight, it's been a bit disappointing.
Oh, yes, I think it has. And for those of us that kind of grew up as children of Apollo, if you like, you know, with 24 human beings flying to the moon, you know, pretty routinely as it got in 72. And then, you know, I was a kid in the 70s and seeing the Viking landers touching down on Mars and then Star Wars came out. It was a kind of heady time. And so in a way, it has been very disappointing in terms of human space flights. And as you say, the robotic missions are still absolutely thrilling and enchanting, but we all kind of want to see another, you know, human being set foot on another world, perhaps. But The reason it was cancelled, of course, is that these last three missions, Apollos 18, 19 and 20, which were, you know, going to take these J-class, these expedition opportunities even further, very ambitious programmes they had. But NASA kind of figured that each mission was very, very risky. And the fact that they never lost anyone in space was down to two things, you know, skill and judgment and engineering expertise, but also in huge doses, a lot of luck. And they figured that if they flew another three missions, you know, they might just lose someone, and was it worth it? So it was put, the plug was pulled on it. It was also pulled, of course, for financial reasons. During Apollo 16, the shuttle had already been announced, and it was kind of greenlit, and it was looking like that was where their future would lay. So going back to the moon and flying another bunch of missions there just wasn't on the agenda at that time.
Chris, let me finish about, with a question about one of the astronauts, Neil Armstrong, who was the one astronaut, living astronaut, that was missing from your documentary last year, In the Shadow of the Moon. You said you spoke to him. Do you think that the 40th anniversary will bring him out? He just doesn't talk to people very much. From the film, you get the sense that he wanted the mission to be bigger than him. Whereas in the end, he turned out to be bigger than the mission.
Yes, I mean, he's a very modest and humble man. And the last thing he would have ever wanted was to be bigger than Apollo, of course, because he saw himself as an equal alongside the 400,000 that helped to put him there. It's a bit of a myth that he never talks about it. I mean, he is absolutely inundated with requests to speak. And so 99% of them he just has to turn down because there's only 7 days in a week. And so many people come away with the impression that he's just doesn't want to talk about it. I was involved with another series called NASA's Greatest Missions recently, which is being serialised on the BBC at the moment in two parts. And he did take part in that that series after a lot of requests. And actually, he's just not a great storyteller. We're very grateful and thankful, well, we should be at least, that Buzz Aldrin was also on that flight, I think, because he will always go down in history as the principal storyteller of mankind's first landing on another world. And just because the commander doesn't want to speak about it too much or doesn't tell stories just as well isn't a problem. He was a great first ambassador.
Okay, well, that's it for our Apollo 11 homage. You can find all of our coverage at guardian.co.uk/science, and please do check the website every day between now and July the 20th for more video, audio and articles on everything from the launch to the landing of the Apollo 11 spacecraft. Actually, Chris, you're going to be selecting some videos for us. Can you give us a bit of a hint of what's coming?
Yes, we're going to go through the archive and pick out, I think it's about seven clips from the archive that'll just be the raw footage of key moments in the mission from training to launch through to splashdown.
So look out for all of that. Well, it just remains for me to thank our guests, Chris Riley and David Adam. The programme is produced by Peter Sale. And until next week, when we return with a full-fat Science Weekly, I'm Alok Jha. Thank you all for listening.